should turn that on.
So I'll just read you a paragraph here. We can see the communicative power of civility at work when people get together to eat. One might think that table manners are a relatively unimportant matter, at most concerned with good hygiene. Yet the sharing of food with others is an important public act, and style, and the style in which we dine transmits important messages about the sort of people we are. During the Middle Ages, as Norbert Elias argued, it was considered appropriate for people to freely express their passions in public. That's a kind of oblique reference to really crude behavior that Elias talks about, subject only to a few blunt controls. Table manners of the time provided a means for displaying that one was acceptably constrained. So eating from the same plate or dish as others was taken for granted. So we tend to think people always got individual servings, but that really wasn't the way food was served in a lot of places in a lot of times, especially in the medieval. A group of people might eat, and a big platter of food would be put down, and everybody's going to eat out of that, right? Which causes some difficulties, right? So one must not only refrain from falling on the dish like a pig and from dipping bitten food into the communal sauce. As the idea of a more finely calibrated and controlled public behavior gained currency, the gradual development of rules for using spoons, forks, individual plates, napkins offered new ways of projecting one's more delicate and refined qualities. Dining etiquette has never been merely a matter of cleanliness. Instead, it has always been a language for communicating information about our trustworthy disposition and our social belonging. Someone whose table manners differ from our own is someone we may find a little unnerving. Henry Hitchings writes, "If he eats a tomato like that, what else is he capable of?" I thought that was funny. But the point there was just does this resonate with you guys? That the way you eat isn't neutral with respect to your identity. That the way you eat communicates. We're going to see this in the reading today, right? That it communicates who you are. Have any of you reacted to, are there things that you've experienced with other people at the table that just drive you crazy, that are like things you just can't have a lot of difficulty with? Where you'd be like tempted, or you would just make a really negative judgment about the person?
This is something people made fun of about me.
Oh, okay, that's
how
nice for sure.
My fork or my spoon.
Yeah, do you hold it in a weird way?
Like, more like this?
You hold it like a, right.
Yeah, like a shovel kind of.
Yeah.
People tell me, like, oh, you're supposed
to. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Table manners. When your parents taught you table manners, that's part of it, is that there's a refined way to hold the utensil. And this had to do with knives, too. You're not supposed to hold a knife in the way that you would use it, like to stab somebody. Because that would make people nervous while they were eating with you, you know? Like. So, anyway, anybody else have pet peeves at the table? Yeah.
Like when people eat food with their hands, that's like meant to be like with a spoon.
Yeah, because we made that conversion.
Yeah.
Because it used to be you would eat food with your hands, and now you don't. And so if somebody does, it's kind of like, yeah.
My stepmom will always, when she's cooking, or like when we're eating, she'll be constantly up, like getting more things, but she'll never actually sit with us.
You know, that's a good one. I hadn't thought about that. That one bothers me. I don't like it. In a restaurant, I really don't like it when a party nearby hovers around my table as they're leaving. I know that's purely private. You know, like if I said, you need to get out of here, you cannot stand there for more than 10 seconds, you know, because I just feel like my dinner's being interrupted by loiterers, you know, near my table. And they might have knives. Who knows? They might stab. Yeah.
I really hate it when people, like, use their fork and stab things really aggressively.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't like that either. Yeah. Yeah. Or cut things violently. Yeah, all
right. Because, like, looking at different cultures, like, I know when I go to a restaurant and I sit down and if I'm, like, famished and the food takes a long time to get out, like, I'm so upset.
That's hard.
Anything sets me off. But then
that's hard.
Like, we're learning about European cuisine culture and, like, you're used to not eating for long periods of time.
Yeah.
And you know it's going to be long, so you don't freak out about it. So I wonder if that's just, like,
it's good
environmental.
Point.
Like, if that kind of affected my...
Yeah, it's social.
The way I react in those situations.
Yeah, I've been with Europeans, and they're calm as cucumbers, and I'm like, where the hell is the food, right? You know, I'm an American, you know, shouldn't you be bringing me food, right? Yeah, good stuff. Any others? Yeah. Oh, we got a lot, yeah.
I can't stand eating with my brother,
because
he eats so quickly.
Fast eaters, that's an interesting issue. Yeah, they don't bother me, but I find it disturbing. Yeah. And like it doesn't make me want to like get away from them, but I'm like, oh, you're done. Oh, wow, what do we do now? You know, because I'm going to take like three times as long.
Same also, like my pet peeve stem from my brothers, but chewing with your mouth open, like that's just, definitely up there.
Yeah, and licking fingers, I can't.
Just like straight up noisiness, but just like a stop.
Some of it's satisfaction noise. Like in some cultures, right? It's a sign of appreciation to slurp your noodles and to show that, oh, this is really good.
That's better though, but like when you're eating food and you're like,
I know,
like,
I know.
Like, you're not tasting anything.
The smacking noise is a problem for me.
And then my brother also eats fast, and he kind of like, he eats something and then he'll run around the house because he has so much energy and he'll come back and eat something else.
Interrupted eating, like.
Yeah. We have this like little like exercise trampoline in our living room, and he'll eat a chicken nugget
like,
and he'll go and he'll like aggressively bounce up and down.
Oh no!
And then like run back and eat another one. So, like,
yeah. Right, right. And you're reminding me, I'm also uncomfortable around people who don't become calm after they eat. You know, people who, like, I don't know. I mean, after you eat, aren't you supposed to be kind of, like, relaxed a little bit? But not everybody's like, yeah.
I was going to say, on the fast eating note, when somebody finishes before you and then they watch you eat, it doesn't drive me nuts. I just am very unnerved about it.
Yeah. It's like you want to give them something to do. You
well,
know?
Like, if you're, like, having a conversation and they're, like, watching what you go in your mouth.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's right. That's right. There are some manners about this is we could do the whole class on this. There are some manners about like covering your mouth and like not Did you guys have something?
I eat fast and I do some weird things eating.
Yeah.
I don't care what you do. I don't know why you guys care what I do.
Good. See, this is one of the big variables is like sensitivity, general sensitivity. Cuz you're like, why are you guys so sensitive about all this, right? Like it's just we're just eating.
Now,
do whatever
you
want.
Fork sometimes.
Use like two utensils. That's great.
I mean, it doesn't bother me when they complain, I guess, but it's like, I don't complain.
That would be a good spoof utensil, to design a utensil like a shovel and actually just give it to somebody. Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah. Good. Okay, funny stuff. And it's relevant because it all gets at that quote, which is like about food and identity. And so good. Okay. All right. I did want to make one philosophy food note. Maybe you've already read this now, so I won't belabor it. But I did feel like last week, and some of you might have missed this class, I felt like last week we were kind of at a point to make this interesting conclusion. You know, that all diets are philosophies of food. It's not just, we tend to think of the special diet, like the vegetarian, the vegan, as choosing a philosophy of food. And it's more prominent, right? Because usually the vegetarian, the vegan has philosophical conclusions of some kind, or a general sense of how to be in the world that is consistent with their diet. What I realized, and I think it's a minor revelation, I guess, in philosophy of food for me, is that all diets are philosophies of food because all diets implicitly communicate presuppose an orientation toward the world, right? A view about where you fit in. Remember we were talking about trophic levels of eating in biblical vegetarianism and everything, and how God kind of reluctantly let us move up a few trophic levels to eat animals. Eventually Christians started eating flesh and blood. So diet and identity are part of this, but it kind of led me to realize that even this mainstream diet, which I labeled whole foodism, right, which we've sort of, there's kind of an implicit message in a lot of the critiques we've read that, you know, and I've called it a consensus diet. I think it is, but now I have to adjust that a little bit. I think there's a consensus diet among upper middle class nutritionists, well, that's among nutritionists in this country, that we should move toward whole foods, limit meat intake. You've heard all this, right? But when you add in things like sustainability, which I think these are all good values to consider, right? You get a kind of whole foodism. You know, you get a philosophical diet. And the point for me was that the facts don't determine the diet. You know, it's not like there is an ideal fact-based diet. And so we talk like that, though. Whatever our preferred diet is, we talk about it like, well, this is the right diet. I mean, unless you're very self... I'm trying to become more self-aware of that because I think it's important to realize that that no set of facts will tell you exactly what to eat. A diet goes beyond that. It involves choices about how you see yourself fitting into creation, how you see yourself fitting into nature or not fitting into nature. So if you're, you know, you can eat a diet that has a lot of industrial foods in it. If you're careful about it, you can have a healthy diet with lots of industrial foods. If you choose not to have industrial foods in your diet, you are likely to say they're not healthy, and many of them aren't. But that's not quite accurate, because you're probably also believe this just shouldn't be in your diet. This is just not the way you want to be oriented toward food. That's a philosophical commitment. And so, anyway, I don't want to belabor it, but I think it's kind of an interesting conclusion. And it's also brought home to me by the students in the other class, I guess, and maybe we don't have any paleos in here. Because the paleo diet, I was very skeptical of it a couple of years ago when I had a student who talked about it. It's a legitimate diet. I mean, you really can get your body into ketosis. It's a different way of burning fuel, and the two students in the other section, you know, their diets are 70% fat. You know, that's pretty scary for a lot of mainstream nutritionists. You know, remember the carb, protein, fat ranges. Well, in a paleo diet, you reduce carbs a lot, and you raise fat levels, and sometimes you do that because your body isn't tolerating, isn't digesting carbs. I've mentioned this Vietnamese medical anthropologist that I'm reading, 100 Million Years of Food. He makes the point a different way. He says, look, don't assume that the Western diet is what other people around the world are eating. Other people in Vietnam are not trying to achieve the same ranges of macronutrients. People in Vietnam might not eat vegetables regularly at all. And he makes the kind of shocking claim that, you know, you can be perfectly healthy without eating a lot of vegetables. Now, to whole foodism, that's kind of like, what do you mean? You know? We don't eat enough vegetables. Our government tells us we don't eat enough. I believe that. I think vegetables are a good thing to have in your diet. His point is that many people have very healthy diets, and they rarely, if ever, eat vegetables. That doesn't tell you vegetables are bad or they don't need to be in your diet, but it kind of goes to the point that global diets vary more than we imagine, and many of them are compatible with health or maybe really healthy. Who knows? So anyway, I think the point for a philosopher is that all diets are philosophies of food, and I think I found that an interesting conclusion. Okay. Any thoughts about that, or, yes, sir?
I mostly like nutritionism. Like, I know we talk about it kind of negatively a lot.
Right.
But I almost feel like that's a philosophy in itself, trying to find the truth behind what our bodies really need and need to function. So I kind of see it as, like double-edged sword.
Absolutely. Pollan could have gone further in acknowledging, and we'll see this when we read some history of nutrition alongside our textbook chapters. We're going to read a little bit about the history of nutrition. And there are some real truths in nutrition science. I mean, we had scurvy, people had pellagia, rickets, beriberi. I mean, these are horrible disease-based nutritions, which we've pretty much eliminated. Well, some of them are coming back, actually. But in wealthy countries, they've been eliminated because we finally figured out, you know, what you need to avoid those diseases. So nutritionism is still, I think it's still an ideology that doesn't serve us well, but we're going to dive into nutrition soon, and I think that's a good point. Yeah, nutrition is real. It just doesn't really, it's not normative. I mean, philosophers would say it doesn't tell you what you ought to do. It tells you some oughts. It tells you some things you ought to have in your diet and avoid, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot more room to grow in far as
absolutely. I think when you read about the microbiome research, when you read about phytonutrients, when you read about people talking about energy balance in new ways, I mean, we are discovering a lot of new stuff in nutrition science, and it's worth paying attention to. Yeah, it's cool stuff. Okay, good. Others? Yeah, very nice. Okay, let's take a look at cuisines of contact and then see if we can kind of figure out when we've gotten what we need to out of that, and then we'll call it a day. I think we'll do pretty well here. Okay, so if you could have that article out, or if you have it with you, or pull it up on your screen, you might have some things that you noted on it that you'd want to bring into our discussion. So basically, there's a few segments. You get a story about Thanksgiving, which is, of course, related to the Mayflower arrival, the pilgrimage. But then you also, later in the chapter, she goes back to tell the story about Jamestown. So that's a few decades earlier. And then in the middle, she gives you a neat section. I wasn't sure why she organized the paragraph quite this way, but, you know, it's fine. She's a good writer and very authoritative. And in this middle, you get some ideas about British, how were Europeans thinking about food? You know, and how did they encounter, how did they feel about encountering Indian food, or foods, native foods of North America? So, and then at the end she kind of ties it together with some comments on the later 17th century. So, you know, after the Pilgrims arrived, so after the Jamestown colony and then after the Pilgrims arrived, there had been, already been trips, people coming over, but the big expansion of immigration in this period was the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which eventually, by the mid-1600s, was hosting the arrival of tens of thousands of people and trying to establish a kind of religious community. So anyway, let's take each segment a bit on its own. Were you guys surprised? Had you heard the debunking story about Thanksgiving meals and Thanksgiving, the original Thanksgiving? Is this news to you, or because? Yeah, this I'll tell you, just give you a footnote on this. This is a book that I'll highly recommend to you. It's a good summer history book if you guys like to read. Good tradition is to pick a good fat history book each summer, right? And so this is a really good choice because it's an attempt to incorporate new scholarship of the last 30 years on what was happening in South America, Mesoamerica, and North America during before Columbus's arrival, right? So it's the story you don't usually get because a lot of times we tell the story from the Columbian exchange, from Columbus. And when you get that, and so she's also doing that. She's up on this research, so her articles, her book's a little earlier. And so the point for your notes is that new history research of the last 30 years has changed our picture of the encounter between Europeans and Native Americans. And we've done a better job of documenting the influence of disease. You've probably heard that story, right? That we caused unknowingly, caused horrible diseases that wiped out huge numbers of Native Americans. And so in the story here, when you get, let's see, where does that come up? I thought the disease thing came up in this segment. But in this chapter, you get, I think it's in the beginning, somebody maybe could help me find that. You get stories about the pilgrims finding unoccupied cultivated land and finding stores of food. Initially, they steal food, right? You got that story. They, on landing, they steal some corn that Indians had set aside. They think of it as sent by God, but they do feel guilty about it, and they do repay it. But as they move inland, the pilgrims encountered abandoned Indian villages, and they were abandoned because the people had died from diseases which had preceded the pilgrims' arrival. In other words, Europeans who had arrived earlier had started the diseases moved faster than the Europeans is the really grim point, really. And again, this wasn't intentional, but it was pretty horrible. And so that colors our perception of the first Thanksgiving. The pilgrims suffered themselves. Only less than half of them made it, you know, to the next to pass the first Thanksgiving. And so our story here is really a story about people seeking religious freedom who are absolutely unprepared for going into a completely new environment. They don't know enough about Europeans don't know enough about agriculture to know that their seeds aren't going to work in the new terrain. They wanted to eat wheat, but you know, corn would have been a better bet. So they have this encounter with Tisquantum, who we sometimes call Squanto, because Europeans called him that. And Tisquantum gets a lot of pages in this history. He's pretty cool. Tisquantum was an Indian who was, you learned this briefly in the chapter, was an Indian who had been captured by Europeans and enslaved and brought back to England. And then won his freedom. I think he took that matter upon himself and got back to the Massachusetts colony or to his Indian nation. And so he really surprised the colonists by walking up to them one day and speaking perfect English to them. And he was also very helpful. He was kind of an intermediary. You get the whole political story in this longer treatment. The point for your notes here is that Tisquantum taught the pilgrims a lot of local gathering techniques, a lot of local planting techniques, some of which he might have learned in England, ironically, including this one very famous thing which Indians did, which you should kind of make a note of. It's pretty cool, which is the idea of planting corn, beans, and squash in the same place, right? So you plant the corn to create a stalk for the beans to go up. The beans return nitrogen to the soil. The squash covers the ground and reduces weed production. And so the three plants, the Indians, of course, didn't know about nitrogen, but they knew that when they did this, they did not deplete the soil. Okay, so you learn about that. Fish fertilizer might have been a British thing that Tisquantum picked up. Maybe you guys have some details here. I think the important cultural detail about Thanksgiving is the last couple of notes here, which is that, was this a surprise? I mean, this was a surprise when I read this book a year or two ago. The point for your notes is that Thanksgiving was a common kind of meal for Puritans. It was a kind of meal in which you designated that you were going to give thanks for that meal. It would have been an abundant meal, and it would have been contrasted with a fasting day. So there were lots of fasting days, right? Not only that, we talked about that in the Christian medieval calendar, but the pilgrims maintained fasting days as a matter of religious practice as well. And so the key idea here is that Thanksgiving wasn't a commemorative holiday even after it became a national holiday. So you learn in this chapter that in 1861, Lincoln declares Thanksgiving a national holiday, but it's not in commemoration of the pilgrims. It's just, let's have a Thanksgiving meal as a national holiday, right? Do you see that point? See, I mean, it's an interesting point. So then you have this woman who writes in the late 19th century connecting it to the pilgrims, and then it kind of takes off as a national holiday. And then the interesting detail, the last detail to add for your notes here in this section is, then it becomes used when there's mass migration at the end of the, she's writing right at the end of the 19th century, mass migration from places like where my grandparents came from, like Sicily, Ireland for some of you. And Thanksgiving becomes a tool of cultural assimilation. And I think there's a picture of it in this chapter, but in another reading there's lots of pictures of dressing immigrants up in pilgrim clothes, which if you think about it is a little weird. Like if I don't know if this happened to my grandparents, but can you imagine like a Sicilian getting off the boat and somebody saying, well, you know, it's time to celebrate Thanksgiving. You need to dress up in pilgrim clothes. You know, it's just not your culture. But that's the key to understanding how food is being used for cultural identity here, right? And it's not insidious. It's in some ways, it's a very healthy thing. I mean, we're a melting pot culture, so the idea of having a food holiday that we can all agree on, or, you know, is kind of useful. So some thoughts about that? You see what we're trying to get out of that? Or what she's trying to communicate about that? Get the nonverbal up a little bit? Okay, good. Yeah, good. Okay, good. And then you learn a little bit about, you get a lot of that in this text, but about war with the Pequot and how it's food related and how, you know, there's some unfortunate stories there. Let's just say that. Okay. So then you go, she takes a digression. I guess she wants to kind of get you acquainted with who these British people were. And in 1491, you learn that the Indians really kind of thought that we were pretty horrible, smelly people. I mean, not us, of course, but the British. Because British people wouldn't have routinely bathed. I don't know if you knew this, but in the 17th century, you just wouldn't regard bathing as healthy. And so, like, you wouldn't bathe at all. Like, so you would smell pretty bad. And Indians were cleaner. And they had different... So we're judging them as savages, and they're judging us as horribly stinky, foul people. So the key idea in this section is just, and this is really not just true about British people, you can make this a big note in the sense that Galen is an ancient Greek physician. He's the guy who gives us the theory of humors. Do you guys remember that theory? What is it? Somebody have it in the article. There's four humors, right? I always get them confused. There's two kinds of bile. And here we are, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. And, okay, this is nutrition science from 400 BC to 1700 AD. That's what I want to impress upon you. This is what we thought. We thought that you had these four substances and that they... I'm just going to read this one paragraph. It's on page 11. So these four substances, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, became identified with certain organs of the body and other attributes. Blood and yellow bile were considered to be warm, while black bile and phlegm were cool. Yellow bile and black bile were thought to be dry, and blood and phlegm were moist. Humors were associated, these are the humors, right? Humors were associated with personality traits. Too much blood was thought to result in a courageous and amorous sanguine personality type. Excess yellow bile turned a person into an irritable, choleric type. Sluggish phlegmatic suffered from an abundance of phlegm. That made you sluggish. While the melancholic, introspective personality had an imbalance of black bile. Both personality disorders and physical illnesses were thought to be the result of disproportionate distribution of these humors. Wow. I mean, maybe some of you knew about Galen in general, I mean, but what do you think about that? So your doctor and your psychologist would be the same person, because food influences character, and so if you're, so you would bloodlet people if you thought they had too much, if they were too sanguine, you might induce vomiting for other reasons. And then foods, put this in your mouth, foods are considered to be warm or cold, hot or moist. So if you had an imbalance, they would recommend a doctor, would say, well, you need to eat more of this kind of food because this you have a deficit of warm, wet food, warm, wet in humors. So the label to give this note is humoral eating, right? And fish, not surprisingly, is thought to reduce carnal desire, so that fits into the religious, remember the religious stuff about you're going to have a fish fast because you're going to try to be more spiritual, so, yeah. The idea that food, that diet and mental health are connected, by the way, is getting a lot of attention with the microbiota research. Your microbiome is related to your mental health. And so there's some really tantalizing, it's still very early, but some tantalizing evidence about that. But it is crazy to think that wine fortifies your blood because it looks like blood. Or that eating an animal, you take on the animal's characteristic. Did you like the detail about the rabbit? Rabbits are fearful animals. You might not want to eat rabbit or you'll become cowardly. I mean, I think we have made some progress since then. Okay, so one side of this section is about how Galen's humoral theory, theory of humors, still ruled European thinking, not just British thinking. And then the other side of the section was how how Indians associated corn literally, verbally, with life, calling it our life, our mother. In the section of this text on Mesoamerica, which is where corn is invented, right, cultivated in 5000 BC, today people refer to themselves as the people of corn. So the identification of life with food, remember we had that when we were reading about soil as living soil. And so you get that again here. But then notice the identity issue. Here's the point for your notes. Pilgrims didn't want to eat corn. It didn't taste good to them, but they also associated it with savagery. So they doubted its nutrition. Imagine doubting the nutrition of corn. So they systematically avoided it, even though their wheat was subject to funguses and it didn't grow well in the soil. Okay. Any thoughts, questions about that? So the point that I would just bring home, maybe it's already in your notes, is that the cuisine, the contact. Just think about what an amazing moment this is to have these two civilizations contacting each other under these circumstances. You have robust Native American cultures. They're thriving. We have towns with significant populations. You know, there are wars. The Indians were in confederations, and they would fight against each other. And that's their culture. But you have this encounter between a religious European culture, which is trying to break away from its home culture and is telling a story. So this is part of the identity, right? Telling a story about their destiny, you know, in freeing themselves from the bad old British. And some of that story gets told in terms of rejecting British eating habits. And then they wind up in this totally different kind of place, and they know they're going to encounter these people, and it's not always going to be a happy thing. And then they have trouble incorporating that diet because it's connected with the identity of people they regard as savage. You getting the point here? Is this coming through? Okay, good. I won't belabor it. I think it's really interesting, but it's kind of maybe it's not so hard to communicate. Okay, so then we go to Jamestown. Now, Jamestown predates the Mayflower and the pilgrimage that led to the first Thanksgiving, so by 20 years. And it's important to note, and maybe you've read about Jamestown, Jamestown was a commercial venture. It was not a religious expedition. So there was a company in England that was investing in the Jamestown expedition, expecting returns in the form of, you know, minerals and wealth of a different kind. So, but again, the Jamestown group was horribly ill-prepared for their adventure. They had people from the upper class, from the gentry, who did not expect to do any manual labor. Things got gritty pretty fast. There was a lot of disease. People didn't know how to grow food there either. They chose a really lousy place to set up a town. And again, they got help from the Indians. Now, by the way, the pilgrims and early colonists' experience with Indians were not uniformly happy, but they contributed to some of that. And some Indians, you learn in this longer treatment, some Indians, right from the start, said to the new arrivals, "So you're not going to stay, are you?" Kind of interesting to think about it in retrospect. You know, you're just visiting, right? And then there's even diaries. This is part of this historical revisionism. It's really interesting. There's even diary accounts that we just didn't used to tell as part of the traditional history of Indians saying things like to the settlers, like, "Well, if it's so good where you came from, how come you're here?" You know, like, they're kind of asking really critical questions about these new people. And they're hoping that they'll just go back at some point. Like, they can't. You can imagine if you're not an exploratory if you're not from a culture that engages in empire and exploration, you might imagine that this would be very puzzling, that these people would come here and say they want to stay. So they help them, and then at some point they stop helping because, as you read from the account, let's make sure this is in your notes, Powhatan initially decides to help, but then the colonists raid villages and murder Indians, and they help themselves to their food. And so finally, Powhatan says, "You know, why are you doing this? You don't need to do this. We're helping you." The Indians, in this case, really fed the Europeans. And so Powhatan decides to stop helping. In 1609, there's a huge starvation leading to cannibalism among the Europeans. And that's kind of the Jamestown story. It's a disaster. I think they send reinforcements, but I think eventually, I should know this, but I think eventually Jamestown just folds. Now, you do get a little information about native diets. Let's see if there's anything here that we should be highlighting. Oh, yeah, you get this great account. This is on page 23. You get this great account from this woman who's captured by the Indians. And so she gives us a kind of inside look at Native American diet. And it would be difficult, I think, for a European. It would be difficult for me. "They would pick up old bones and cut them into pieces of the joints, and if they were full of worms and maggots, they would scald them over the fire to make the vermin come out, and then boil them and drink the liquor." That's actually bone broth. That's actually what Jenny Van Cott is selling, you know, but it doesn't have maggots. Don't tell me. Sorry. It can be really healthy, bone broth. She confessed to gratefully eating portions of deer fetus and bloody horse liver. They would eat, you know, animals' ears. Somebody once served me sheep ears. It didn't go well. Horse guts and ears, all sorts of wild birds, bear, venison, beaver, tortoise, frog, squirrels, dogs, skunks, rattlesnakes, even the bark of trees. By the way, there have been studies of Indian nutrition. Indians were extremely well nourished. It was a tough culture. I mean, it didn't tolerate weakness, you know. But in this book, there's some evidence from, you know, from forensic archaeology where we can look at bones and we can kind of figure out what people ate or how well they ate. And Indians ate really well. They were very well nourished. So that's kind of the conflict of diets, again, an identity issue. And a challenge between the two cultures. The title of the chapter says it all, Cuisine of Contact. Okay, the chapter kind of concludes on just reinforcing really the religious model that's in place once, by the time you get enough migration of religious, not just Puritans at this point, but other people as well. And so the key point here is that, you might regard this as a bit superstitious, but I'll try to put it in a sentence. The Puritans saw the morality of their community and their food security as connected. Is that a good way to put the point in this section? Puritans saw their morality and their food security as connected. So pests in the food, crop failures, might be a consequence of, you know, fornication, theft, you know, bad behavior. This is the period where you have this famous preacher, John Winthrop, I think he's mentioned here, who gives us the fiery speech, Cotton Mather, I'm sorry, gives us the fiery speech of, you know, sinners in the hands of an angry God. So the basic idea here is that the pilgrims were trying to build a new kind of religious community, and they connected food and morality extensively. And they also, they managed their community centrally. So it was not, you know, it was not a laissez-faire democracy, right? This was a religious, it was kind of theocracy. You could be voted out of the colony, and you would have to kind of go talk to the Indians about buying some land. So this is part of our, what do you guys think about, can we make a few speculations before we adjourn about what it means that we're part of a culture that has this in its history? I mean, this is really very unique about our food culture. I'm tempted to try to connect some of the ideas in this chapter to the ways that we eat today. Can anybody think of some connections here? See if we can do a little work here together, 5 minutes or so. Does this tell you anything about us today? Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I think is interesting is like how we viewed corn as just a savage food, and now like every
oh my god, that's huge. Good, good point.
All the corn products now.
We went from cornophobics to cornophilics. Yeah, I mean, we're just growing corn like crazy, trying to feed it to fish, trying to feed it to our cats. Eat more corn. Yeah, good. That's a very good connection. What else? I kind of think of the religious search for purity and the desire for purity in whole foodism as connected. I think Americans have very adulterated diets, we're also the culture that originates organic and food concepts that involve, you know, being very natural and pure. So no pun intended, but the Puritans' experience of food and religion might have carried into the culture in the sense of our emphasis on purity. Anything else? We also had an agricultural culture encountering a hunter-gatherer culture, right? And so that's a huge clash. Yeah, anything else? There's some connections. We're going to be able to make some connections with when, what is this, Tuesday? With Thursday's reading, because you're going to read another chapter from Wallach in which she's going to give you she does the best job I've seen or have read of telling you the story of Kellogg and Post and the you know, the cereal magnates that grew up. And that's a story about food purity. So I don't want to anticipate Thursday too much, but this idea that the pilgrims have this religiously based food purity concept is going to be reflected in the 19th century. Kellogg had a whole spa. I hope you enjoy the chapter. It's really interesting. And Americans went for a health craze based on a conception of food purity. This is when we invent granola, for example. Yeah.
Can we go back to using pilgrims in relation to the culture?
Good.
The way that you dress immigrants in clothing clothes?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like we flipped into the point where like food is a way to like introduce people to culture. Because like so like varied now, like you know, the mixing pot or whatever, that like, when people come over to my house, like I want to feed them Mexican food and like come eat my food.
Good, yeah.
A way that we connect with each other, not necessarily assimilate, but like introduce and kind of like create those like foundations.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, food and identity is partly about loving our food. You know, we're seeing it in a clash here, but we tend to fall in love with our diets in a way that makes us want to promote them to each other. And sometimes we want to promote a traditional ethnic diet. Sometimes we want to promote a discovery, like, you know, I stopped eating meat, it's the greatest thing I ever did. Or I stopped eating carbs, it's the greatest thing I ever did. You know, whatever your diet is. So I think it's really important to remember that we have a psychology that allows us to invest in our diets so deeply that we connect them, that we advocate. You know, we just, like you said, when someone comes over, you kind of want to say, well, here's what I'm eating. This is going to be really great, right? Maybe not, yeah. But usually if it's traditional foods like that would be. Right? Good connection to make. Yeah, anybody else? Okay, guys, hope you have a good week before the break. And, I'll see you on Thursday. Right. Enjoy the next chapter of Wallet. Okay? See you.